All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're diving into a really interesting Wisconsin Supreme Court case today, one that I think a lot of you, especially the law students out there, will find pretty fascinating. We're looking at State Ex Rel. Kalal v. Circuit Court for Dane County.
That's a good one. It really digs into, well, the whole question of when a judge can sort of step in and look at a prosecutor's, decision on whether or not to file charges. Like, where's the line between their discretion and the court's oversight?
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a tug of war sometimes, right? Prosecutors got a lot of power, but the courts need to make sure things are running fairly.
Right, right. And this case gets into the weeds of criminal procedure and statutory interpretation, too, which are always fun.
Always fun, absolutely. So, to set the scene a little bit, the case revolves around Michelle Jader. She had the suspicion that her former employers, Ralph and Jackie Kalal, were up to some shady business, possibly embezzling from her retirement account.
Right. Pretty serious stuff. So, naturally, she reports it first to the Madison Police Department, and then, when that didn't seem to go anywhere, she took it to the Dane County District Attorney.
And I'm guessing, given that we're talking about a Supreme Court case, things didn't exactly go smoothly at the DA's office.
You guessed it. Despite Jader's reports, the DA's office decided not to file any charges.
Okay. So what did Jader do next? I mean, she clearly felt that something wasn't right. Did she just give up?
Not at all. She's a fighter, this Michelle Jader. She turns to a specific part of Wisconsin law, Wisconsin Statute, Section 968.02, Subsection 3, I believe.
Okay, and what does that statute say, the part that Jader was using to fight back, so to speak?
Well, the key language is, and I'm quoting here, if a district attorney refuses or is unavailable to issue a complaint, a circuit judge may authorize the filing.
Okay, so that's where things get interesting. Jader goes to a judge and basically says, hey, the DA is refusing to take action, so I need you to step in and let me file this criminal complaint myself. But the whole case hinges on how we interpret that one word, refuses, right?
Exactly. The Kalals, they argued that refuses means the DA has to explicitly come out and say, nope, we're not filing charges. A very clear and direct refusal.
But Jader's argument was a little more nuanced, right? She was basically saying the DA's inaction, the way they were handling it all, basically meant they were refusing, even if they weren't saying it outright.
That's it. And that's the heart of the debate. What does refuses really mean in this legal context?
And it raises these really fundamental questions about our legal system, right? Like, how much power does a prosecutor actually have, and when, if ever, can a judge overrule their call?
Absolutely. The Wisconsin Supreme Court had to wade into these pretty deep waters. They had to figure out how much discretion prosecutors have in charging decisions and when a judge can intervene.
So what did the Supreme Court decide? How did they interpret that word refuses?
Well, they ended up siding with Jader. Their conclusion was that for the purposes of this statute, a district attorney doesn't have to explicitly say no for it to be considered a refusal. A refusal, they said, can be reasonably inferred from their actions, or actually even their inaction, as long as it reasonably implies a refusal.
So basically the court said there's no magic word, no I refuse stamp that needs to be used.
Exactly. It's more about the totality of the circumstances.
Okay, but what kind of specific actions or inactions would make a court say, yep, that looks like a refusal to us?
Well, in this particular case, a big factor was the significant delay by the DA's office. We're talking months here. Months where Jader reported this alleged embezzlement, and the DA's office just, well, didn't really do much. No charges filed, no real movement on the case.
So it wasn't a quick no, it was more like they just kept kicking the can down the road.
Right, and the court saw that as a problem. If a DA could just endlessly delay things, it could essentially kill any chance of a case moving forward.
That makes sense. Justice delayed is justice denied, as they say.
Exactly. And there was another piece of the puzzle that the court found pretty telling. The DA's office had actually told Jader that she was free to proceed legally in whatever manner she believed necessary. Now, on the surface, that might sound like they were giving her options.
Right. Like, hey, you do you. We're not stopping you.
But the court saw it differently. They interpreted it as a pretty clear signal that the DA's office wasn't planning to take the lead on this case themselves.
So it wasn't a direct we refuse, but it was pretty close.
Exactly. Plus, there was even testimony from a deputy DA who admitted that, yeah, the way the office handled things did seem to suggest a refusal to act.
So all those pieces together painted a pretty clear picture for the court.
Right. They upheld the lower court's decision, saying that the judge had been right to let Jader file that complaint.
This does feel like a pretty important check on prosecutorial power, right? I mean, it prevents a DA from just quietly blocking a case without actually formally refusing it. But couldn't the DA's office have had some legitimate reasons for the delay? Reasons that weren't necessarily a refusal? How did the court address that possibility?
Oh, that's a really important point. And the court did acknowledge that prosecutors do have a lot of discretion in deciding which cases to pursue. That's a vital part of our system. But they also said that this discretion isn't unlimited. It can't be used to basically nullify the right that's laid out in that statute, that's section 968.023. In this specific case, the long delay and the statement about Jader being free to proceed suggests to the court that the inaction wasn't just due to a careful investigation or a difficult decision. It was more like they'd made the decision not to prosecute, just implicitly.
Okay, so for all those law students out there listening, why is this Kalal case so important? What's the big takeaway for their budding legal careers?
Well, I think it gives them a really good look into how statutory interpretation works and how the different parts of our legal system balance each other out. It shows that courts don't just look at the dictionary definition of a word like refuses. They look at the context, the purpose of the law, and what would happen if you interpret it in different ways. I mean, imagine if they've just taken a super literal meaning of refuses here. DAs could just avoid any kind of judicial review by being vague or stalling forever.
Right, that wouldn't make much sense.
Exactly. So this case reminds us that the law isn't always black and white. Sometimes you got to read between the lines to make sure the law is actually working the way it's supposed to. And this case shows how that interpretation can be a sort of safety valve, making sure the system doesn't get gummed up.
And it also shows how even simple words in a statute can lead to some pretty complex legal arguments.
Absolutely. And, you know, even the concurring opinions in this case highlight that. Chief Justice Abramson, she agreed with the main decision, but wrote her own opinion to emphasize the importance of taking a broad view when interpreting statutes. You got to look at the whole thing, not just a single word, she argued.
And Justice Bradley also concurred, but you mentioned earlier that she took a slightly narrower approach.
Yeah, she agreed that the judge was right to allow the complaint, but she specifically said that she wasn't joining the broader discussion about statutory interpretation that the majority opinion and Chief Justice Abramson were getting into.
So even when judges agree on the outcome, they might have different reasons for getting there.
Right. And it's important to remember that there are often multiple pathways to the same legal conclusion.
So, zooming out a bit, looking at the bigger legal landscape, what does this Kalal case tell us?
I think it really underscores just how vital statutory interpretation is for anyone working in law. It's a core skill, and it highlights how courts try to balance things out. They look at the plain language of the law, what the legislature intended when they wrote it, and what happens in practice if you interpret it in different ways. They're trying to avoid interpretations that just don't make sense or lead to crazy results.
It's almost like the court is saying, we get what refuses usually means, but in this specific law, given the situations it's dealing with, we need to think about it a little differently.
Exactly. They realize that being super literal about the word could actually defeat the whole purpose of the statute, which is to give people a way to get a complaint authorized when the DA just isn't acting.
That makes a lot of sense. It's all about context, right?
Right, and purpose. Now, you might be wondering, were there any dissenting opinions? Any judges who thought refuses should be interpreted more strictly? What were their main concerns?
That's a really good question. But in this case, actually, the decision was unanimous. All the justices agreed on the outcome, though, as we talked about with Justice Bradley, their reasoning wasn't completely identical. This agreement across the board really reinforces how strong this interpretation of refuses is.
Absolutely. The fact that no one dissented suggests there's a pretty broad consensus that a refusal doesn't have to be spelled out in so many words.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into state ex rel, Kalal, is there one last thought, something to chew on that you want to leave our listeners with?
You know, I think this case really pushes us to think about the whole balance of power between prosecutors and judges. Prosecutors have a ton of discretion, but when should a judge step in and maybe question a prosecutor's decision? And how does this balance play out in other areas of law, not just this specific statute? There are no easy answers, and this case gives us a really good example of how courts wrestle with these really fundamental questions about power and accountability in our legal system.
A lot to think about. Well, that about wraps it up for this deep dive. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks for having me.